Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome here to the Mark Steiner Show once again, and to Soundbites, our weekly production on food farming and our future. And you listen to the Soundbites here, produced out of WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Letting you know that what you heard going on the way to break before was Mary Travers singing the First Time I Saw Your Face, her rendition of that, from Peter, Paul, and Mary. The great Mary Travers passed away on this day in 2009. And reminding you on the way to this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. Their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is right there. We are starting off our sound bites talking about chickens, a subject near and dear to the heart of this program. We talk about it a great deal. Someone looked at my chicken wing on my desk and said, why it's so small? That's because it ran free before we got to it. But anyway, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, or you can just go onto our Facebook pages. Purdue announced that it was cutting back its use of antibiotics on chickens in just recently, and we were going to do a program listening of the week about that. But they're the third largest chicken producer in the country, and has stopped the use, they say, of human antibiotics in 85%, 95% of its chickens, though it's still using animal antibiotics with about 2/3 of them, and will not use it in their hatcheries anymore. So this was a huge development, and there's been a huge battle going on around what all this means. We talked to Purdue. They could not come on, provide anybody. They gave us some folks to talk to. Most of those could not join us, but we do have an interesting panel here to wrestle all this. In studio is Mitch Jones. Mitch Jones is director of the Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch. Dr. Keev Nachman is a director of Food Production and Public Health Programming at Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. And Dr. Gail Hansen is with us. She serves as senior officer for the Pew Charitable Trust Campaign on Human Health and Industrial Farming, a project aimed at phasing out the overuse of antibiotics in food production. Before joining Pew, Dr. Hansen served as a state epidemiologist and state public health veterinarian for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. And Dr. Gail Hansen, Dr. Keev Nachman, and Mitch Jones, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So when we see this announcement by Purdue, from your perspective, I mean, what does this say to us all? And then we'll get into kind of the meat of what antibiotics really mean or don't mean in our food. Dr. Hansen?
Well, I think it's a big deal that Purdue has made this announcement. It's something that the other chicken companies, I think, should take stock of and see if they can do the same thing, that Purdue's managed to get rid of most of the antibiotics that they're using, and I think they can set a model for the others.
Keev?
I tend to be a pessimist, but I will say that there is one element of great news in this, and that is the cessation of use of antibiotics in the hatcheries. That is a big deal, and like Gail said, that is something that we should hope other chicken companies would come along to in the future. I'm a little more skeptical of their claims about the ending of use of human antibiotics in 95% of the birds they produce. There aren't a lot of details provided with that announcement, and I have questions about whether we're talking about specific human drugs or whether we're talking about the classes of drugs that are important to humans. We don't have answers from Purdue on that, and we'd really like to know in order to judge whether or not that statement's very meaningful.
You want to jump in on this as well before we... Mitch?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what I would like to add is... that instead of counting on the other companies to follow suit, I think we should be calling on the government to actually issue regulations that affect this change. This is something we've been calling for a long time. And while it's nice that Purdue has decided to do it, what we actually need is government action to get the antibiotics out of the poultry and the wider industrial agricultural community.
Well, I'm going to go back to what you just said as a historical question and chickens in America. But Dr. Hansen, let's talk about that. I mean, are there things missing in this Purdue announcement? And what do you think it really means in terms of their antibiotic use? And what questions we should be asking or not asking?
There was not, as was mentioned, there's not a lot of specifics in the Purdue announcement of just, you know, which antibiotics they're using, how much they're using, what their decrease in their, the, what they call the non-human antibiotics are. And so, you know, more transparency and working with FDA and other agencies to get more transparency, get more data to everyone, getting that out to folks. You know, whether that's something that all, you know, it's really something that we'd expect from all of the companies.
I mean, so I want to make clear for our listeners here, for everybody to understand this. So, I mean, to me, I mean, this is I've interviewed the folks at Purdue. I've walked with them in their at the farms that they work through where they raise their chickens. I've did extensive interviews with Purdue over the in the beginnings of this program, and so I mean when they announced they're no longer using antibiotics in their hatcheries, and that to me is a huge step forward, and it's a response to people being concerned about the use of antibiotics. So, does that take into account antibiotics, whether they're animal antibiotics or human antibiotics, that are used in feed? Does that cover this as well, or is this covering the injections into the hatcheries?
So they're kind of separate matters. I think the injections in the eggs, we're all in agreement that that's a good thing. And like Mitch, I think it shouldn't be up to the individual companies to decide whether or not that's okay.
That should not be, you say?
It should not be. I think FDA should prohibit the practice. But now when we're talking about feed, it's a separate matter, and that's where we start getting into semantics and not truly understanding what their intent is and what their actions are going to be based on what they've said in their press releases.
But one of the things, if you go back in history, though, that the use of antibiotics in raising animals on large scale in chickens that began really in the 40s for the most part was, I think, seen by many as a way of raising chickens for the masses of people to be able to eat in America, and the use of antibiotics cutting down on diseases that chickens suffered while they were being raised in these large industrial farms that began in the 40s. So, I mean, that's where it began. And so people think of and expect to have chicken available that they can eat. So if you're having large scale, is there any other way to raise a large scale industrial chicken without the use of antibiotics? Some people would argue no.
Some people would argue no, but clearly if Purdue is able to take this step, it shows that they are able to do it. And that's something that we've been arguing for quite some time, is that with the proper management of the flocks by actually regulating this industry properly, they can raise the chickens that we need in a more healthful way, not only for human health but for environmental health. And these announcements that Purdue made recently just show that they were capable of doing this. And, you know, what we need to do is put pressure on the FDA and on our legislators to see that everybody makes the changes that are necessary to do that, because this just shows that what they've been telling us for years they can't do, they actually can do.
Gail Hansen, let me ask, what's your sense of that? I mean, about the ability to use or not use antibiotics or other things similar to that in raising chickens on a large scale?
Well, all of the large chicken companies have at least one line of chickens that they say are raised without antibiotics, or an organic line of chickens which are raised without antibiotics. So, you know, as been mentioned, it can be done and it is being done. There are smaller companies, sort of mid-sized companies, that have been raising chickens without antibiotics or with limited use of antibiotics for a long time. So it's not that it can't be done. It's something that there has to be the will to have it happen. Antibiotics were used, they found sort of happenstance that it made them grow faster, but that was back in the 50s, and how we raise birds now is very different.
There's actually scientific evidence that supports the idea that we can raise chickens without antibiotics. I mean, two studies come to mind. One was conducted by a colleague of mine named Jay Graham, who actually had data from Purdue to look at flocks raised with and without antibiotics. And his study found that they actually lost a little bit of money per bird using antibiotics. There's another really important study that came out of Texas A&M in 2009 that looked at 500,000 broiler chickens and fed half of them an antibiotic growth-promoting regimen, the other none, and found very little difference, if at all, between the two flocks of birds that were produced. So really, the science says we don't need to do it. And I think the true empirical evidence is the widespread availability of organic chicken.
Well, widespread availability of organic chicken that most people who are working in middle class can't afford.
That may be the case.
So, yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem, is that mass-produced chickens make chicken affordable for people to have.
But, Mark, getting back to one of the two studies that Keith just mentioned, the industry is actually losing money when it does the antibiotics, which seems to suggest that the economics could even be there for the mass-produced, so-called mass-produced, affordable but healthier chicken. And I think that now, you know, Purdue is aggressively trying to move into the organic line. This has been mentioned around this announcement that what they're doing is they are actually trying to expand the organic side of their business. And so that's why they're doing some of these things. And then we had this somewhat stunning Reuters report come out yesterday about the use, which I'm sure you're going to get to.
But you
know, this came out.
I mentioned it.
So there's this Reuters report that came out yesterday, which is a great investigative piece looking at the actual practices as opposed to the reported practices of poultry companies and their use of antibiotics, especially in feed. You know, I find the timing of the Purdue announcement, which kind of came out of nowhere, being just a few days before the release of the Reuters report, which they clearly knew about because they were interviewed there, you know, in the article. I would call it suspicious, but or convenient, if you will. You know, because a lot of people were asking me, well, why did Purdue do this now? Why did they announce this now? And I didn't really have a good answer for that until yesterday. I think, you know, there are a lot of concerns, which Keith highlighted, about what's actually being done as opposed to what's being claimed. And this Reuters report that came out yesterday, you know, really does kind of blow the lid off of that question and raise a lot of new ones.
And Pilgrim Chicken, which is who they focus – was it
Pilgrim's Pride.
Have threatened to sue them, to sue Reuters unless they divulge where they got the material and what it said and what those they learned from the tags and tickets,
right,
which is the thing that describes what's inside the feed that's given to animals. So that's And they, of course, and Reuters said, no, we're not going to show you anything. So this question is really important. One of the things I've been reading about in preparation for this brief conversation we're having this morning, Gail Henson, is that we really don't know the effect of using these antibiotics have on creating diseases that are resist antibiotics in our culture, right?
I would argue with that point.
I would argue that point as well, that we actually do know that feeding antibiotics, and especially low levels of antibiotics, animals does create antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and those get into our meat, they get into our environment, and they cause disease. So we do know that happens.
I mean, I think something a lot of people don't realize is I hear from vegetarians all the time that I don't eat meat, so I'm not contributing to this problem, and I'm not affected by this problem, and that's not true. I think something a lot of people miss is that waste from animal production sites where animals are fed antibiotics is used to fertilize crops. And so the vegetables that you buy at the store, even organic ones, can harbor antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
But what about the argument the industry makes that the levels of antibiotics used are too low to cause any kind of real damage or danger to the public or to the soil or to creating these diseases that are resistant, antibiotic resistant?
The low levels they use kill off the weaker bacteria and leave the microbial ecosystem ripe for the more resistant, stronger ones to prosper. So I don't think that argument goes very far.
Right. We do know that every use of antibiotics can select for antibiotic resistance, and the low levels in some ways can make that process go even faster. So the low levels, you know, it's relatively speaking low levels, but they're still there. And as Keith mentioned, those both the antibiotics and the antibiotic resistant bacteria get into the manure, and that gets in lots of places.
Right. And Mark, I would just point out the FDA reported that in 2011, so 3 years ago, which I think is the most recent information we have, that 80% of all of the antibiotics that were sold in the U.S. were for agricultural purposes.
80%.
80% were for agricultural purposes, not for human health, not for use in hospitals, not for treating human sickness, but for raising animals in an agricultural context. And to me, that's just it's a really shocking and, quite frankly, outrageous fact that once you begin to realize that this is what we're doing with our antibiotics is we're using it in this way, then you begin to see the real breadth and depth of this problem. 23,000 Americans die every year because of antibiotic-resistant infections. 23,000. This is a growing problem, and we need to make sure that we protect our antibiotics for human use instead of giving them to these animals in these non-therapeutic, when it's not necessary, when it's not needed to, you know, save the life of a flock or in other contexts with, you know, hogs or cattle. We need to make sure that we're not driving these resistant antibiotic-resistant bugs so that we can actually have antibiotics work so that when our loved ones get sick and they go to the hospital, the drugs the doctors give them can be effective. But, and that's a real crisis that we're beginning to face.
Are you arguing here that the use of those antibiotics is a direct link to those deaths?
I am arguing
Animal feed in our animals?
I'm arguing that the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in agriculture is leading to the creation of antibiotic-resistant bugs that can infect humans, and that we're seeing a growth of this across the United States.
It's absolutely a part of that number. I mean, the problem is that we don't know with certainty just what fraction it is. And I think there are reasons for that. And part of it is that we can't go onto farms and sample bacteria and microbially link them to some of the infections that we find in people. And that would help us get a better handle on what fraction of that 23,000 plus fatal infections are actually a direct result of using antibiotics on the farm.
We know of a couple of the bacteria that are specifically animal bacteria that are responsible for over 400,000 infections every year and deaths every year. And those are bacteria that really live in animals. They're really not widespread in humans. And Salmonella and Campylobacter are the two that come to mind. But they're the antibiotic-resistant bacteria spread their resistance all over. So we can't just hone in on those two, but those two are at least a place to start and to start looking. But yeah, we do know that we can trace some of that back.
One of the things that Reuters article said, and I'd ask you to comment on this in the time we have left, the farmer was quoted saying, Craig Watts, who grows chickens for Purdue, says he saw little difference in the outcomes for the birds he raised on feed containing antibiotic and those he grows for the company's antibiotic-free line. And Purdue mixes the antibiotic Naresin into feed given to chickens to the company's antibiotic-free line. So what does that really mean? I mean, the line here is its antibiotic-free line contains antimicrobial drugs that kill microorganisms, but none of those FDA defines as antibiotic, according to Purdue feed tickets shown by Watts. What does that mean?
So I think the focus there is that there are antibiotics that are not important in human medicine or not used in humans, and that they're continuing to use those in the context of poultry production. And I think the industry will say that, you know, since they have no relevance to human medicine, we don't need to be concerned with them. And I think the jury's still out on some of those drugs. We don't have a full understanding of how their use may or may not contribute to bacteria becoming able to survive in the presence of human antibiotics.
So, while I guess Gail Henson, this is a step forward. I mean, the people are saying that the announcement of Purdue. I mean, it seems that in the larger industry, especially beyond Purdue, but also within Purdue, I mean, what are the questions we need to be asking and probing now?
Well, I think we certainly, as I said before, we need some more transparency, and the companies do need to be reporting what they're using and reporting them in a way that can be used for public health and for health issues. I think we need to know more. Purdue has said that this is one of, you know, this is not their final step. So it would be interesting to find out what that means and really what they are doing to try to reduce antibiotic use in their flocks. What drill down and figure out what do the details mean? What do they really mean by that?
One of the things in this report, Mitch, says, throw that in Keeve, and you can come right back in along with Mitch. We have about 7 minutes. We've got time to wrestle with this, is that The article said that first of all, we're going to be linking to this article by Reuters. The internal documents came from Tyson Foods, Pilgrim Pride, Purdue Farms, George's, and Koch Foods, and that Donald Kennedy, who was former head of the FDA, saying that this systemic source of antibiotic resistance to bacteria might be traced to all of this that we're seeing, that we talked about earlier in the program, but that there are, U.S. regulators do not monitor how drugs are administered on the farm and what doses, for what purposes, and for how long. So why is that important? How do we get there? How would that change the nature of what goes on in the farming communities that we have?
If they were monitoring, we'd have a better idea of how to trace some of the human infections we observe back to the farms. And I think one of the big challenges here is this claim that drug use on farms is confidential business information. If the industry is going to claim that the use of drugs in their farms is proprietary knowledge, my question is, you know, if you're only using drugs to treat sick animals, then how could that information be used by another company to enhance its own business? I don't think that's possible. I think what it suggests is that the drugs are actually being used to promote growth, and they've found a formula that they think works best, and that's why they want to hide that. So really, it's not about treatment.
Yeah, I think it's telling that, you know, referencing the Reuters article again, that they quote a vet from a veterinary doctor from FDA who says, and I have the quote in front of me, "None of us have an idea firsthand of what's going on at the farm level." I mean, that – this is the FDA. This is a veterinary medical officer at the FDA. They have no idea firsthand of what's going on at the farm level. That is a shocking statement and a shocking indictment of the FDA's inability and unwillingness, because that's really what it is, unwillingness to get a grasp of this problem and do something about it. And they're saying here that it won't be until 2016 before they start to really gather this information. That's a year and a half away. Not quite, but almost. Right. This is an unacceptable political situation to be in. And, you know, there were hints in this article as well that folks on Capitol Hill are aware of it and want to address it. But, you know, we can't rely on the whims of Jim Perdue to make this a better industry. What we have to rely on is turning that consumer pressure, which Perdue announced was their reason for doing this, into political pressure to make sure that the whole industry cleans up its act.
Gail?
Right. I was just going to say that without having more detailed information than what we've got, which is broad brushstrokes of just how much antibiotic in general is used in agriculture, we aren't going to be able to come up with good solutions unless we know which animals use antibiotics are given to and for what reasons. We can't really come up with good solutions. We're sort of stabbing in the dark. And one of the things that FDA had said is trust but verify. We have to figure out a way to verify, and we've got no tools to do that right now.
So the question is this something that happens on a national level, or is it something on a state-by-state level?
I think we need to be pushing for national action at this point. We can't rely on the individual states to be doing this. You know, this is a national industry. It's not a state-by-state industry. Obviously, it's concentrated in various places, like Maryland, like Arkansas, like North Carolina.
Right.
But, you know, I think what we really need, it's not a problem, though, that's just limited to those states. It's a national problem. It's actually a global problem. The World Health Organization has named this antibiotic resistance growth a real problem. It said it could threaten all of the advances of modern medicine. I mean, this is a real issue that affects all of us, and it goes much broader than just what Purdue is doing or what Tyson's or Pilgrim Pride is doing or even just what the poultry industry is doing. It's not a local issue. It is a national and global issue, and that's where we need to be pushing for real action.
Closing quick thoughts. Keeve and then Gail, we have about a minute left, and a half.
Mitch summed it really well. I guess one thing is, you know, I'm encouraged again to see the cessation of use in hatcheries. But even if we move towards responsible antibiotic use in animal agriculture, it's not going to solve all the problems that we're facing with these operations, especially in Maryland.
Gail Hansen.
Well, I think the Purdue announcement is with getting the drugs out of the hatcheries is also, I also believe that's a good first step. But it's a first step, and it shouldn't be our last step when we're combating antibiotic microbial resistance.
Dr. Leah Hansen is Senior Officer for the Pew Charitable Trust Campaign on Human Health and Industrial Farming, a project aimed at phasing out the overuse of antibiotics in food production. Dr. Keith Nachman is Director of Food Production and Public Health Programming at the Johns Hopkins Center for Livable Future. Mitch Jones is Director of Common Resources Program at Food and Water Watch, and encouraging you all that Food and Water Watch is screening the movie Resistance at the Rotunda Theater in Baltimore on Thursday, September the 18th. That's this week, tomorrow actually, 7 p.m. The film delves into the history of antibiotic resistance, starting with mass production of antibiotics 70 years ago and tracking the rise of superbugs in the 21st century. Following the screening, local activists and experts will present a panel to answer questions and more. You can find out more information at foodandwaterwatch.org. Good to have the three of you with us. Thank you so much for this discussion.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
We'll be right back. Don't go away. We have more of Soundbites coming right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you listen to Soundbites, produced here in Baltimore, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and heard on DeMarva Public Radio. Last month, former Soundbites intern Maggie Dyer and producer Stephanie Mavronis visited Cherry Hill Urban Garden in Baltimore City. Here's their conversation with the founder and farm manager, Juanita Yule.
My name is Juanita Yule. I'm one of the managers of the Cherry Hill Urban Garden. The Cherry Hill Urban Garden is an initiative of the Cherry Hill Development Corporation, which is a longtime community association concerned about bringing new development and dealing with community issues that are of importance. Through the Development Corporation, we identified several areas of problems in the community that we wanted to be involved in, and one of those areas was food. We do not have a grocery store here in Cherry Hill. We have to go outside of the community to go to a supermarket, and the closest market is approximately 2 miles away. And a lot of the people in the community don't have their own cars. They rely on public transportation or illegal cabs, which are called hacks. So people pay hacks to take them to the store. I'm a longtime resident of Cherry Hill. I grew up here as a child, and I moved away as an adult, but then I came back to Cherry Hill, and I've been here now for about, this time, maybe about 30 years, and then I was here about 30 years before that. At any rate, when I retired, I wanted to get involved in the community to try to help make improvements in the community, to help identify and have some input into working on various problems in the community. And when the Development Corporation identified food as one of our problems, I knew that was an area that I wanted to get involved in. So we looked around the community and found a suitable spot, which is the field that we're on. The field that we're on used to have public housing on this field, but about 15 years ago, those houses were torn down, and it's been a vacant lot since that time. The size of the lot is an acre and a half. It had a lot of trash and trees and weeds and so forth on here. So once we identified this area as the spot we wanted to grow in, then we made a proposal to the Housing Authority of Baltimore City, who are the owners of the land, and the Tenant Association of Cherry Hill. We made a proposal to them to allow us to use a portion of the land to grow vegetables for the community. in addition to bringing food to a food desert, which Cherry Hill is, another issue is health, the health of the community. And we've done a lot of research ourselves, and we do know that education of our students or their ability to do well in school has a lot to do with whether they eat nutritious foods. So we feel that growing food in the community and showing the residents how the connection between your health and your eating habits would also help improve the kids' grades in school. So we're on a campaign to connect nutrition with eating healthy, and hopefully we will develop to the point where economics will come into play, because hopefully as we grow, we can employ youth here at the garden and we can teach them the skills that they need that would be beneficial to them in life, such as how to work a market, how to plant vegetables, how to present food, how to grow it, preserve it, cook it, the whole nine yards, and how to appreciate it. So we started in 2010 with the proposal to the Housing Authority. Then it took us a year. So by 2011, we had the field cleared. We got about a ton of trash and trees off this field. And then we built our infrastructure. We built 24, we have 24 raised beds that we built, and we grow food in those 24 beds. In addition to that, we have 16 rows of vegetables growing. Those 16 rows are, each one is 65 foot long and 4 foot wide. So we have the potential to grow a lot of food and feed a lot of people. We now consider this to be like a living classroom. We're trying to develop it into a living classroom because we give tours, we entertain the kids, we give them opportunities to learn to grow. They come from the schools, and we show them how to grow, what we're growing, and what we need to do to make it grow nice. And we encourage the teachers to engage their students in this type of agriculture. We also recycle. With very limited funds, we have to create most of the things that we need. So we recycle all of our waste and make our own fertilizer. And we don't use any chemicals or any pesticides. And because we have no machinery, everything is done by hand. We plant seeds. Everything is grown from seeds. And we just nurture it until it grows. And we sell it here at the garden. On Saturday mornings, we have a market from 9 to 1, where we sell the vegetables that we grow. In addition to the Cherry Hill Market on grounds at the garden, we also have a stall at the Waverly Market on 32nd Street, run by the Farm Alliance. We work very closely with the Farm Alliance. They have been very helpful, very beneficial in bringing some standardization and professionalism to what we're doing, because we were more or less winging it. So it's been a blessing to be a part of the Farm Alliance. We've been growing vegetables and selling them for the last 2 years. I would say by 2012, we were growing and selling. And we don't know how long we will be on this field because we're just using it. So whenever the Housing Authority tells us we have to leave, we will be leaving. However, we feel that we can get a lot of food grown before that time.
You talked about community outreach. Do you see a lot of people in the community coming and buying from you on Saturdays and helping out with the farm?
Now, that's been a problem so far. We've been successful growing the vegetables, but we haven't been able to get the community involved like we'd like to. We're in dire need of volunteers. We will take volunteers wherever we can get them from. However, we encourage people in the community to come and get involved. But a lot of young people just aren't interested in farming. I'm talking about teenagers, young adults. It's difficult. And then a lot of them work. So, you know, it's hard to get the help that we need. We are working very diligently doing community outreach activities to try to encourage the community to get more involved. And in addition, we're part of a nonprofit organization, so what we sell, currently everything we sell, the money we make goes right back into the garden because that's how we sustain ourselves. We're self-sustaining at the moment. Eventually, as sales increase and the market expands, we are going to take the money we have to handle other community areas where there is a dire need. So we see this as an asset to the community, and we will be able to help others in the community who are trying to develop good things in the community. Area in here, we develop it for the community use. We have this large open space. We can have garden events, community events, block parties, whatever. We can accommodate at least a couple hundred people in this open space here and not interfere in the garden. And over here, we have what we call the possibility garden. It's designed so people with disabilities will be able to engage in gardening activities. We have two beds there that are wheelchair high, so a person can be in their wheelchair and work in the garden, work while sitting in their chair. And those tall boxes there, those are for people who are not necessarily confined to a wheelchair, but they can't bend or stoop, so they can stand at those boxes and work in the garden. And over here, this is a herb garden, herb and cut flower garden, that's also in the stage of development, but it's coming along. But what we have is all sorts of herbs and cut flowers, which we are growing to sell. And we made a path so that you have a walking path through the garden. We have all sorts of herbs all around here. That whole area is filled with herbs and flowers. And we're going to put small seats and benches up in there so people who want to just come and enjoy the ambiance of the garden can sit there. It's a shaded area. Down this way, you can see those large piles down there. That's the compost that we make. We save all our waste from the garden, and we recycle it and put it back into the dirt, and it feeds the plants. And we have 24 raised beds down here that we built to grow vegetables. We produce quite a bit from those 24 beds. We just finished up with our lettuce. We had a lot of lettuces and salad greens, things that have small roots we grow in our boxes there. And we're getting ready to plant our fall crop there. And over here, midfield, where you see those small trees, those are fruit trees. That's our mini orchard. We have about 12 fruit trees. We have apple, pear, cherry, peaches, and figs. And this structure here, this is our greenhouse, but every time we put it up, the storm tears it down. It allows us to extend our growing season because, you know, it gets warm in there and it stays warm and we can grow far into the winter. And on top of that, this is where we nurse our sick plants. This is where we start special plants or things that we don't want to plant in the field. We grow them inside here. Right now we have a variety of tomato plants in there. And we have some collards and cabbage that we've started over in those trays there. And these are our 16 rows. Right now we have Swiss chard, beets, all kinds of peppers, squash, and cucumbers that are grown and ready to sell. This is sort of the end of our season. You know, it's coming into the end of our season. So we have the bare rows that you see there, the bare ground. They are newly planted, but of course that'll be our fall crop. The rows where you see the plastic covering the rows, when we finish with a row for that particular crop, we pull all the debris out and then we cover it with plastic. We wet it down and we cover it with clear plastic. That's called solarization. That's how we cook our insects and insect eggs and kill weeds and everything. So we put that plastic on there and leave it on there maybe 4 or 5 weeks. And then when we start off, we're able to start off with pretty clean soil, no bugs. You know, bugs lay eggs. You get the bugs out, the eggs are still in the dirt. So this allows us to get a head start on the insects. And we also use these bathtubs. When we have our market on Saturday, on Friday we pick our fresh vegetables and we fill this tub with water and we wash the vegetables that we sell. So our vegetables are nice and clean when people buy them. After we wash them, we wrap them and put them in coolers in the shed until it's market time. The people are very pleased with the clean, fresh vegetables. And we don't waste anything. I said that before. You can see this hose running from the tub. We run this water out the tub over to our greenhouse, and that's how we water our plants in the greenhouse. We drain the tub into the greenhouse area or into any other area that needs water. But we don't waste anything. We recycle everything, put it that way. We collect rainwater in the barrels, but we don't have a lot of structure here on ground, so we don't have a lot of gutters to give us rain water. However, we have barrels that we just cut the top off of, put a screen on it, and we just catch rainwater any way we can. But we keep the barrels filled with water so that when we need water, we can just go to the barrel and turn the spigot on and have water available when we need it. This is our part of our workstation. This is our shed that was built by, that was donated to us by Home Depot. And so this is where we bring our stuff and weigh it and band it for sale, bag it, whatever we need to do. This is our workstation, and this is where we keep our coolers.
When the time comes where you'll have to give back this land, are you going to try and find another vacant lot, another spot for you to kind of continue your work here?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm retired. I retired in 04, and I'm 72 years old. So the thought of finding another lot and starting over again doesn't really sound that great to me. However, I love what I do. I love gardening. I love my community. So no matter what, if I'm not actually out there finding the land, I'm going to be somewhere in the mix, encouraging, hopefully, the younger ones to and offering my assistance, my advice, my encouragement. I'm going to be on the scenes in some capacity, but I don't look forward to starting over.
For people that are interested in volunteering for the garden, where would you advise them to go to contact you?
Well, they can go to our website, which is cherryhillurbangarden.wordpress.com. And that has all of the contact information there. In addition, we are here Monday through Saturdays from 7, 8 in the morning until 1 or 2 o'clock every afternoon, every day except Sunday. So if someone wanted to volunteer, they can just come. I mean, we always have plenty of work. We always need help. And we are happy to have visitors. And in addition to volunteering, we want people to come and see what we're doing, because a lot of people just don't know or don't have a clue that we're doing this in Cherry Hill, and we're so proud of what we're doing, we want the people to see and know that Cherry Hill is on the move, and this is something, this is a community project. This was something that the community itself is doing. Because of that, we want people to come and see. We want to give out some good news about Cherry Hill. We want to show that we're about doing some positive things. So you'll hear about something besides crime statistics.
And where can people find this? Is this the 900 block of Cherry Hill?
Cherry Hill Road. The Cherry Hill Urban Garden is located in the 900 block of Cherry Hill Road. The entrance to the garden is on Veronica Avenue. Cherry Hill Road is the main road that runs through Cherry Hill. And the garden is located up in the area, at the top of the hill, up in the area where the churches are located. And so if you can find where the churches are, the garden is right beside them. And we're also right across the street from the Senior Manor Senior Center, which is a senior residence building. So we're not difficult to find. And there's plenty of parking. We'd love to, for people to come out and volunteer. Or come and take a tour. We give tours all the time.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables.
That was Cherry Hill Urban Gardener, founder and farm manager, Juanita Yule. The Cherry Hill Urban Garden, located at 900 Cherry Hill Road in Baltimore City, is hosting the Cherry Hill Harvest Festival this Saturday, October the 18th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. More information at Cherry Hill Urban Garden on Facebook or at cherryhillurbangarden.wordpress.com.
It's time for our monthly visit with Ava, Ava Chin, author of Eating Wildly, Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal. And September, fall is beginning to come in. Summer is waning.
That's right. September is a great season for foraging. Next to spring, it's probably the best, or it might even be better than spring, and I'll tell you why. In the fall, the new shoots of the green leafy vegetables come out, so we'll find new shoots for dandelions, new lamb's quarter shoots, and these are the tender versions of these plants, and they can be used in anything from salads to wild greens pies to side dishes. So, but in addition to that, one of the reasons why I love fall so much is because it's mushroom hunting season. Mm. And so some of the best mushrooms come out during this time of year. So this month, you should be able to keep your eyes out for maitake or hen of the woods mushrooms. These are polypore mushrooms, which means if you turn them upside down, they don't have gills underneath, but they actually have like these little tiny holes. Right, these little pores underneath. And hen of the woods mushrooms, you find them on the menus of high-end restaurants. They're a delicious, earthy mushroom that are often found at the base of oak trees. So keep an eye out for those. There are also chicken mushrooms or chicken of the woods. And these are bright orange mushrooms that also grow at the base of trees. It's hard to confuse a chicken mushroom for anything else because of the color of it. It's like a bright orange mushroom. It's also a polypore.
Do you saute them or you cook them in a stew?
Yeah, you can saute them. You can put them in a stew. You know, I have friends who just saute them in butter with garlic and they add them to linguine. You know, it's they're quite delicious. And I think anybody who's a vegetarian who misses the look or flavor of chicken would really appreciate a chicken mushroom.
Without using the tofu, you have your chicken right there.
That's right. That's right. So just a good guide for a mushroom hunting, because it's really important that you correctly identify your mushrooms, right?
Or you can get very sick otherwise.
That's absolutely right. So there are two things I would suggest. Maybe join your local mycological society. These are mushroom clubs where you might be able to find mushroom experts in those clubs. Where I am, I'm a member of the New York Mycological Society, and we have like some of the best experts in the country who are part of the group. One guy that I really like a lot is Gary Linkoff's Audubon Society Guide to North American, Northeastern Mushrooms. It's a really great guide.
All right, mushroom time. Thank you so much,
Ava. You're welcome.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer, WEAA 88.9 FM, is Andre Melton. Our intern is Sianna Greaves. To podcast the show again, and find information about our guests, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and the Marvel Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.